morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I have our first guest, Tim Henney. He is the Park City Councilman here to talk about last night's meeting. Thank you very much for coming in this morning, Tim.
My pleasure, Carolyn.
So let's start off. You made a comment about the government shutdown in last night's meeting and how it affects mountain lands specifically. Scott Loomis said if the shutdown continues another month, they would need to take action. What kind of action is he referring to?
Well, he didn't go into specifics, but I do know, and he did comment on how a great deal of their funding is from federal sources, different agencies like the Rural Development Agency, and also not only for construction and loans on the final product that they're putting people in to affordable housing, but also from the standpoint of staffing. They have some of their staff salaries that are paid for by federal grants. So he said that they were fine for a month. They have enough in the pipeline as far as money that was already delivered or in the process of being delivered to keep them running as they are for a month. But if the shutdown were to continue beyond 1 month from yesterday, because that's when they had their board meeting, that it would start to have impacts. And I just found it interesting, you know, when we hear about the government shutdown, we hear about the 700 furloughed federal workers, those who are being required to work without pay because they're essential service providers, that sort of thing. And it sort of seems isolated in kind of that group of 700,000, which is big. But then you start to think about how it impacts communities across the country. And if Mountainlands in our little community is sharing what would happen, I think it's easy to extrapolate how that same situation probably is impacting thousands of communities across the country in ways that's kind of a ripple effect out from the initial federal in Washington, D.C. impact.
Mm-hmm. And what other ways might the federal shutdown impact Park City?
Well, I would just believe that Scott is probably, and Mountainlands is probably one of a handful, and maybe more than, maybe it's a number of handfuls of local nonprofits that rely upon some level of state or federal funding. And even the state, you know, the state gets a lot of federal funding. We get a lot of transit funds through federal agencies. So, you know, there could be a connection there. Our transit department didn't bring that up. So that's not one that I would necessarily say we need to be particularly concerned about. But, you know, you can see how, again, the threads kind of move out and the ripple effect goes out into local communities and the organizations that depend on that sort of financing. I don't know who that is within our community, but Scott Loomis, Mountainlands being one example, I have to believe there are more.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about the emergency mass notification services. And the city has been putting those services into Spanish language and making it available. We had a bomb threat on December 13th, 15th, something like that. The challenge seems to be getting the information out to Spanish-speaking communities. And I'm just wondering, what are the ideas that the city has for the outreach campaign to get emergency messaging out to all members of the community?
Well, the emergency messaging notification system, you have to opt into. So that's really the key. The message can be delivered in any form or format that we choose or desire it to be delivered in. So that's not really the hang-up. The hang-up is getting anybody to opt in and to request that they are part of that notification system. Some groups within in our community are more readily available to learning about those sorts of things, and our challenge is to deliver the message that this is available and it is something that would be helpful, and to ask people to opt in across our community.
So what about partnering with the school district, say? I imagine their distribution is extensive.
Yeah, we talked about how they've got a you know, they've done well with this. And I think we can learn from them and probably, you know, they've broken the trail. We can follow their path and figure out how to do that. I'm sure they would be willing to share, you know, email lists and contact information. And then, you know, once you kind of get to a critical mass of adoption, I mean, I think there's the 10% rule. Once 10% of early adopters adopt something, then you've created a critical mass and it just kind of has an organic life of its own. And gains traction. So I think that's the key for us, is just kind of getting to the whatever threshold that is. Maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 20%, maybe it's 40%. We have, I couldn't tell you what the subscription rate is now, but I know I get text alerts, and I know a lot of people, you know, are alerted via text when there's something going on. And, you know, think back long enough when the bear ran through Park Meadows and through the U.S. Bank parking lot there. I mean, I was hearing about that on my phone. So, Those are the sorts of things that are being alerted.
Well, and it's a good segue into the conversation about hosting the World Cup Championships coming up, and not to mention, of course, our annual Sundance event. Many, many, many thousands of people will be coming through town in the next month. And what is an emergency protocol? What happens if there is an emergency?
Well, it could be all sorts of things. If I know you're using Sundance and the World Championships is the example. So let's focus on that. If there's a car accident on Deer Valley Drive that blocks Deer Valley Drive, that would be something that could be notified. It would not only go out onto the variable message boards that line up on 224 so people are aware, but it would also go out in text form to the local community so that if you're intending to travel and you get that, you'd be like, maybe I'll wait for 2 or 3 hours until that gets cleared up. That's the idea. It could also be used for security issues. You know, if we have a suspect who is in a neighborhood, it has been used for those sorts of things as well. When police are in a neighborhood searching for somebody and they're out with their flashlights, they send a notification to that neighborhood that if you see flashlights, you know, on the street, in your yard, be aware the police are there and they're looking for someone. That's helpful and reassuring to neighbors. So it's for those sorts of notifications.
Okay, and text sign up, people who are interested, can they find that on the parkcity.org website?
I'm sure. Mike McComb is our emergency manager, and he can be found on our city website as well as the emergency management email and phone number. And so contacting it and maybe doing a search on the Park City website would be the easiest way to come up with that information.
Okay, thanks. And then the World Championships, let's talk a little bit about those.
Sure.
People are comparing it to Olympic-sized crowds. And what do you have any sense? What are we talking about? Is there some ballpark number that we're anticipating to come through town during that event?
Well, the ballpark numbers seem to be kind of fluid, but they're sort of talking right now about 60,000 people over the course of the event. Now, you know, the event is spread out between Solitude. I believe the first 3 days are over in Solitude, and then Park City Mountain, as well as Deer Valley. So the venues are spread, and the first 3 days being over in Solitude, that shifts a lot of the impact, and that's the overlap with the end of Sundance, which kind of makes that work. But it's basically going to be Sundance-type crowds for another 7 days or so. That's, I think, what we can expect. And I heard Matt Dias put out a plea to the community to, not just tolerate this, but really embrace it and use best behavior, because I think we've really shown what we can do when the community is asked to help. This last summer, we had a lot of changes in concert venues, and the community really rallied around that and facilitated traffic flow, pedestrian flow, using public transit, and that's what we need again. And so, yes, I mean, we're all in this. We're all benefiting from it. It's a free event for our community, and it's, you know, a world-class event that's coming just below the level of the Olympics and well above the level of World Cup. And that's something that most communities never get to experience, and we get to experience on a fairly regular basis. So my perspective is let's not take it for granted. Let's embrace it and let's help this system work as effectively and smoothly as possible.
Okay. Now we're looking at our two corridors, 224, 248.
Yep.
We're going to ideally open up Richardson Flat with some services.
That's just going to be for carpooling.
Oh, it's only for carpooling.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you say that, what does that mean? Will there be shuttles running frequently out of Richardson Flat?
Not from Richardson. That's not the plan. It's for, let's say, you know, you got a bunch of people coming from different locations and you've got six cars and they all go to Richardson Flat and the six cars get condensed down to one or two. That's the idea of Richardson. So it's just a lot that enables carpooling to take place in a fairly convenient manner if that is something that people choose to do. Now, that would be a great thing to choose to do because if you can reduce six vehicles to two vehicles, you've really had an impact on traffic congestion and traffic flow.
So are we providing any incentive for people to do that? Will there be dedicated carpool lanes or bus lanes offered?
No. Not off of Richardson Flat. We do have satellite parking that's going to take place in kind of what are the normal parking areas for this type of an event, for more of a World Cup type of event. Those will be the school parking lots and the base of the resorts, both Park City Mountain and Deer Valley, after 4 o'clock. Those lots will be available and used as they have been in the past.
So how, if we're looking at crowds that equal the Olympics, why wouldn't we be putting in place some services to keep people from driving into our box canyon here?
We have put in services, but the feeling was that, you know, there's a trade-off, and sometimes it's productive and sometimes it's counterproductive, and the determination was made by events, by the event staff and the transportation staff and our public safety staff that they've come up with a plan that does not include activating Richardson with shuttles, but allowing it for carpool. And that was the decision that they arrived at. They explained that last night, how they got there. I couldn't give you the details, you know, but it was extensively explored. And this is where they landed. So I'm supportive of where they've landed. They've done a really nice job of mitigating traffic. And we've got a traffic control center. We've got a flow, a one-directional flow out of the base of Deer Valley Resort, which was used last summer during one of the bigger concerts as a pilot program. So there have been a number of steps that were put in, and they just felt that having Richardson Flat would actually be slightly counterproductive to this effort. You'd have to ask, you know, them the specifics of how they got there.
Okay. And as far as the resort's involvement, their employees, many thousands of employees a day are coming and going. What is the engagement on the part of the resorts during this time frame?
Well, again, that's not something that I know the specifics on, but, you know, as a resort, you have to make a decision who uses your scarce parking resource, right? Who's it going to be allocated to? Is it going to be allocated to guests, to visitors, or is it going to be allocated to volunteers and employees? So I don't know what Deer Valley and Park City Mountain have decided to do. I would think that it would be in everybody's best interest, including theirs and including their business model, their, you know, free market profit driven model, to not take up their scarce parking resource with employees and volunteers. And at the same time, these are employees and volunteers, so you want to give them a benefit. So I would think that you would want to create some form of transportation that would make it convenient and easy and you know, maybe even more convenient than it is for your guests. But when you're parking, when you're creating free parking at the base of your resorts for your guests, you know, that's a tough one.
Yeah. Well, and Alfred Knott's transportation manager, he talked some about possibly using charter buses.
Well, that's a...
was that in...
Yeah, that's kind of a contingency plan. We have given authority to spend up to $160,000 to augment and supplement our existing fleet if necessary. And the idea is, if we were to lose any of our rolling stock, which just happens from time to time, you have a bus or two that goes down for maintenance. I think they referenced one that was in the shop last night. And so that happens. And if that were to happen in one of our peak demand for transit time frames. How would we fill that gap? How would we address that? And this gives them the resources to address it with rolling stock and drivers that we wouldn't normally have at our disposal. We don't have surplus and extra drivers and rolling stock sitting around in case something happens. The water department, as an example, has a lot of redundancy built into the water system, because if some portion of the water system goes down, you have to have redundancy to fill that in. If some portion of our transit system were to go down for whatever reason, we don't have redundancy.
Okay, so
that would have a system-wide impact, and we want to avoid that.
Okay. So his discussion was really a contingency plan. It wasn't part of the program that we're offering.
Well, it fits into this program because this is one of the peak times when it could theoretically be used. So it is available, it's at their disposal, and it gives them that redundancy that they are looking for. And it's just kind of a comfort level. I mean, without it, you know, things get a little anxious.
Sure. And how do we plan as a city to get the word out that there are carpool lots set up and that buses are available from other areas around town, other satellite lots like the high school and the and so forth?
I think you just took care of that, Carolyn. Thanks.
All of our listeners are listening to this story. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some of the venues and the costs associated with bringing in these events. And there, a fee waiver has been asked for by the organizers of the World Championships. Where is the city on this?
Well, we approved it, and we actually approved it during the budgeting process. It was included without any real detail or specifics, but we had a ballpark number, which were within. You know, we authorized and approved an amount slightly larger than what was granted in the application last night back during the budgeting process. So last night's fee waiver was really just a formality of you know, putting the whole package together. And
okay, great. So what about Park City Heights, the housing update? It looks like we're a bit off schedule. Well, the developers are a bit off schedule. There are 79 attainable affordable units out of 239 units. About a third of those, I guess, then are supposed to be attainable and affordable. 20 units have been finished and sold. 25 units are under construction. 20 of them are under permit review. Where are things on that? I mean, is the council pleased with where that's going, or?
Oh, Carolyn, you're walking me into that one. You know the answer to that. They should, by agreement, have delivered and sold 24 at this point. That's using the minimum number of 8 over the 4 years that that they've, you know, been building and selling these houses. So they're a little bit behind schedule. Nan Worrell made a point and has made the point at every opportunity, and I share her perspective, which is, you know, we entered into an agreement that we are unable to enforce the delivery. So we have to live with it. We've learned from it. We will not enter into agreements in the future where we cannot enforce delivery. We've also seen, you know, a slower delivery of product on even the projects that we do for similar reasons to what are being cited by Ivory Homes. But it leaves all of us with a sense of frustration and a little bit of distrust as to what we're being told by Ivory and their hope to deliver. And a hope to deliver is a lot different than what has been delivered. And what has been delivered does not meet the agreement. So therein is the frustration that was being expressed last night. Now, okay, if they can deliver the 45 units that they plan/hope to deliver in 2019, and there is good, solid evidence that they can do that and that they are actually on track to do that, because as you pointed out, they have 25 under construction right now, they will actually leapfrog way ahead of where they would otherwise be obligated by agreement to be. And that obligated is the squishy part, because without the ability to enforce, what's an obligation?
Okay, and that was going to be my next question. What consequences, if any?
Yeah, there really aren't. You know, we get pledges, and pledges are as good as, you know, as good as a pledge is without enforcement.
And this is affordable, attainable housing, which
it's got a few affordable that actually fit within the AMI, and that was clarified last night by Ann Laurent and our housing staff, Rhoda and Jason. So there are some affordable. The majority of these 79 units are attainable, which is a different range on the AMI. It's generally from 100% AMI to 120. It could even possibly go up to 140, something like that. But in relative terms to Park City, we have to keep this in mind. If you can buy anything from 80 to 140% of AMI, it's a screaming deal. And people are lined up to do that, knowing that these are deed-restricted properties, that their appreciation will be limited, that that they have to be primary owners, that they can't rent, they can't do short-term rentals. You know, there's all sorts of restrictions on these, and people are lined up because it is many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars below free market housing of the exact same unit.
Okay. Thanks, Tim. That's Tim Henney. He is a Park City Council person. Thanks for coming by.
You bet.
You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. My next guests are Shelley Worley and Serene Brooks. They're here from the Summit County Health Department to talk about Diabetes Awareness Month. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
So, Shelley, let's start with you. How does a person know if they have prediabetes or if they're even at risk for type 2?
So it is a little tricky because one out of three adults are pre-diabetic, and 9 out of 10 of them do not know they have it. It's difficult to diagnose because you really don't notice any symptoms or have any signs that are easily recognizable. So the best thing to do is to have a conversation with your doctor. You can get a blood test and have a conversation with your doctor and just really be upfront and ask them if you are struggling with prediabetes, and they will let you know. So the blood test, there's an easy one, an A1C test, that will give you the numbers that you need. And that's the easiest and the best way, is through a checkup with your physician.
Okay. And then let's talk a little bit about the diabetes prevention program that's being offered through Summit County Health Department.
Yeah, sure. We're really excited about the diabetes prevention program. We've been running it here at the health department for about 3 years and seen a lot of great success. And like Shelley said, because there's no symptoms to prediabetes, if you know you have prediabetes, this is a really, really important time to have this opportunity to do something to make some lifestyle changes, because that's basically what it is. In order to prevent getting type 2 diabetes, there's just some lifestyle changes that can be made, and learning how to make those changes is what we do in this diabetes prevention program. You also may be at risk for diabetes and not have a diagnosis of prediabetes. And those type of things come through just your genetic makeup, your family history. If you've had gestational diabetes, you're more at risk for type 2 diabetes. Your physical activity level and your weight to height ratio, those kind of things all are indicators of if you might be at risk for type 2 diabetes, and that's what this class focuses on. So if you don't have a diagnosis of prediabetes, but you are at risk, you can also take this class, and we can explain where to find that risk test. It's on our website, as well as if you just Google search ADA diabetes risk test, you can find it online as well.
What are the risks?
So those would be the things that I just mentioned. So the older you get, the more at risk you are for diabetes. If you're a male, you're more at risk than female. If you've had gestational diabetes, if you're more sedentary or don't have a lot of physical activity during the day, you're more at risk. And if you're not in a healthy weight range, then you might be at risk as well. So this class is facilitated by trained lifestyle coaches, and it focuses on making those changes. So it focuses on increasing physical activity and what that means. Going for a brisk walk for 150 minutes a week is the type of change you'd be making. 5% weight loss has been proven to reduce the risk for diabetes. And then obviously your ultimate goal would be to lower your A1C so that you're back down in a safe level. One thing to keep in mind with this class that's really important is Medicare is now covering diabetes prevention. So if you're a Medicare recipient, your benefits would cover the cost of the class. And so that would be a great time to also join up with this diabetes prevention class.
And we're talking about type 2, which is so more of a lifestyle, mm-hmm. not so much like when a child is dealing with diabetes. Is that a type 1?
Yep. So and type 1 diabetes thing. Is completely different. Type 1 is an autoimmune. You really can't prevent type 1, and that would require insulin in order to manage that disease. Type 2 is more something you manage or prevent with lifestyle. Once pre-diabetes develops into type 2, then a lot of times it does require more of medication and definitely lifestyle change to manage. And so that's why it's so important to try to prevent getting into that part, because once you have type 2 diabetes, you kind of always deal with those effects of it, and you always deal with that management part of it. If you can get from pre-diabetes and go back and reverse that, you don't have to, you know, have that where you're always trying to manage the disease.
Do you, how many diabetic patients does the Summit County Health Center see or treat?
Diabetic patients or mm-hmm. pre-diabetic?
Both.
We actually, at the health department, we do not see patients. We've been working mostly with, through this program, we see pre-diabetic patients, and we've had over the last 2.5 years, we've offered several classes, and in each class, we range from 10 to 15 participants in each class, and we've had great success within each class with weight loss, increased physical activity, behavior changes, and people have been able to lower their A1C to a healthy range.
Okay, and then the A1C is a weight to height ratio?
No, so that is actually, Serene can probably explain it a little more in detail.
Yeah, that's a blood test that a physician will do to determine where your blood sugar levels are. And if they're in a healthy range, great. If they're in a little bit elevated but not high enough to be diagnosed as type 2 diabetes, that's when they consider it pre-diabetes. And then if it goes higher, then they diagnose it as type 2 diabetes. And so that's just kind of a clinical marker. So for these participants that are in the class, if they later go back and get their blood work done again and we can see that their blood sugars have come down, that's a good clinical marker that this class is working for them. And the most important part, well, that is one of the most important parts, is getting that blood sugar down. And the other part is that they've made lifestyle changes that they can sustain in order to continue on that road to diabetes prevention, which is really an important part as why this class is so successful.
Okay. And tell us, when and where is the class and how can people sign up?
So our class will begin March 6th, and it'll start at noon and go until 1. Sometimes it'll only be 30 minutes. Sometimes it'll take 45 minutes. We're holding it at the Summit County Health Department, which is 650 Round Valley Drive, right out by the Park City Hospital. And you can go to summitcountyhealth.org/diabetes class to sign up and register for the class. And then we will follow up and contact you and go into more detail about the class. The class you can attend in person, or we will have a web-based video that you can come into the class if you need to be at work during the day and you just want to get on your computer and attend that way. We offer that too.
Okay, like a live stream.
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you. That's Shelley Worley. She is the Health Promotion Director with Summit County Health Department, and Serene Brooks, Health Educator. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That's slightly better.
Okay, well, I got you all
the
way up on my...
It can be, so be it.
I've got you all the way up on my monitor, so... Welcome. Thanks for joining us, Skip. And so the band is performing this weekend. Tell us a little bit about your time with the group as the manager and what you're doing now with the band.
Well, I've been with Canned Heat on and off for 52 years. I was the original manager and produced all their early records and hits from going up the country and On the Road Again, Let's Work Together, all of those which are being used now for movies and commercials. We have the number one and number two most played commercials in America right now using our songs. Geico Insurance, we're using Going Up the Country. And like, where did Bill and Bob go? Oh, they're going up the country. And they go sing that. And then we've got the biggest company in the world, Amazon, using Let's Work Together. And we never figured that would be part of our legacy down the road 50 years ago, making those songs. But the band unit right now has been together, these four guys, for 10 years. Two of the very originals, Fito De La Parra, the drummer, percussionist, and Larry Taylor, that they call the Mole, playing bass and guitar and singing also once in a while. And he's been there from the very beginning as well, and also on all of Tom Waits' records, as well as 50 other artists through the years. He's one of the most used bass players. So the other two guys, Dale Spaulding, has been with us now, as I said, 10 years, a harmonica player originally, all the way back to Ray Charles and Dr. John and lots of the Zydeco and kind of bands of New Orleans. And he is lead vocalist, guitar, harmonica, a little of everything. And John Paulus, known as JP, who was with John Mayall, playing in his band for 8 years prior to Canned Heat. And he's been with us on and off for 10 years now, playing both lead guitar and bass. And it's, from my point of view, the second best lineup we've ever had, the classic lineup all the way back into the 60s with Bob Hite and Alan Wilson. Henry Vestine is still my favorite unit, but these guys are true to the Canned Heat sound and attitude, and they're able to do a lot of the original stuff because of Larry Taylor playing bottleneck and slide guitar now as well. And the energy the band has today is as great as it's ever been, and their message and some various blues songs that they do, as well as blues rock originals, still bring the excitement and the message of music to the world. And we're looking forward to playing at the Egyptian, thinking it's about the best indoor venue in America, and the refurbishing of that building and that theater with the sound and lights and seating for the audience. It's as good a place to see a band as anywhere in the U.S. And we really look forward to it because of the production company that's there and what they do with GoPro cams and old video and photographs, and they really enhance the musical performance, and it makes for a real good night of entertainment for the audience.
Well, fantastic. It's getting harder and harder to fill auditoriums these days. Does the band have anything new in mind for the performance this weekend? I mean, as far as songs or anything that they're going to surprise the audience with?
Well, it's, you know, I mean, being the type of band they are, they play all their own stuff. I mean, it's not like they're doing covers or a tribute band or something of that nature. They are always evolving. We have right now the sets, two 45-minute sets that are set up for Friday night. Come Saturday and Sunday, who knows what we'll do.
So maybe,
I mean, they change every night. They don't do the same show ever.
Okay, so maybe if you're a Canned Heat fan, you better get tickets for each night.